or the Lean Into Artcast, a show where a couple of digital storytellers get together, walk around a difficult topic. No guests this week, so we're back to classic Lean Into Art, where we zoom out 10,000 feet up to handle our topic after taking on a creative curveball. And then we get down on the ground to take all these abstract thoughts and congeal them into something that is usable and useful to you, the listener. And then we close out with a quest for you guys to take on for the next time, where we'll all get back together again and talk about these creative challenges. My name is Jersey Drozd, that other guy.
Hi, I'm Rob Stenzinger. How you doing, Jersey?
Okay, except for the fact that something seems to be devilishly playing with my desktop computer. So doing the Lean Into Art cast the way we have been doing it, with all the sounds and the music and the one take thing, isn't happening. Whenever I try to launch Hangouts on my desktop, the Google Talk plugin crashes and I can't figure out what's going on with it. But you gave me some advice that I'm going to try this coming week, playing around with a program called Console. I'll see what I can find out by playing with that.
What I don't recall, so if you or any of the listeners here on Mac OS X, I can't remember if Console is installed by default or if you have to actually go install the developer tools. Either way, it's highly available for you, and it's free.
I'm finding it in my applications folder right
okay,
now.
Okay, perfect. So. All right, you're good.
Hooray for this.
Yeah, I mean, so if you run Console, you can see all sorts of things that your computer is spitting out as logs. And anytime there's something really going wrong, it could be, I think, as I said, sort of screaming in silence, because you can just be using your computer, you know, nothing, no big deal, but your computer is inside freaking out. And for some reason, it's not telling you anything. It's just screaming it via its log files. The Console lets you check out.
I'm looking at it now. Yeah, I'll have to look at this in more detail. It's going to have to wait for a few days, sadly, because I well, let's just get to curveball. I can share takeaways later on if we have time.
Cool. You know, I miss takeaways. We haven't had a chance to do a takeaway. Let's see if we can do it. I know we're on a tight timeline. Who knows, right?
Well, we'll just stick to the timeline, and then maybe we can fit it in. So curveball. Hit me with the curveball, Rob. You said you had a good one.
All right. Well, I think it's very relevant, and we could just call this. It's also setting up for our main topic as well. And what's funny is you actually sort of tiptoed near it before when we were setting up, and I thought, I better not say anything. I'm going to give away the curveball. But okay, on the topic of our quests, Lean Into Art quests. If you haven't heard of what this is yet, basically we roughly every episode will have a mini art challenge that we're hoping will be a fast and useful exercise to help explore something pertaining to, well, being a visual storyteller. So it could be writing related, or it could be, it could be anything related. I mean, you know, that we talk about in Lean Into Art. We even go into business, being independent and all that kind of stuff. But there was one of these little conceits related to quests that here's the curveball. What do you think, Jersey? Are the quests too hard so far? Or do we make them hard on ourselves?
Oh, that is a good question.
You went from boring to,
Are the quests too hard, or do we make them hard on ourselves? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm gonna be a jerk, and I'm going to spin it back to you. This reminds me a lot of when a young student of mine asked me she asked me what religion I practiced. And I thought, this is an opportunity to find out what she thinks of me. And I said, what do you think I practice? So I'm going to say, out of curiosity, just keep it brief. What do you think my answer would be to that question based on how I've often operated on this show?
So this is, I operate on hunches a lot. So I have a hunch is essentially a hypothesis, right? Where I think you have a lot of experience facilitating people through incredibly wild, fun adventures in the classroom setting. And I think having you there facilitating helps time box stuff. And the thing is, I've written a quest too, and I spent way too long on my quest. Not the writing of it as much as the execution and taking the quest. And, well, let's see. So I'm not just pointing this at you, but I'm thinking like,
sure,
just at how both of us are writing the quest so far, right? Are, you know, so how do I think you would answer? I think your answer would probably be related to, the general size and feeling, because I've seen you perform this kind of thing live as well. And it totally could fit within like 5 minutes or, you know, probably more realistically 15 to 20, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm guessing they're probably about the right size for you. And for that use.
We artists have a tendency to make the work harder than it has to be. I'm going to point everybody at, did you get a chance to watch that TED talk that I talked about in Thunder Punch Daily, Rob, the one by Young Ha Kim, Be an Artist Right Now?
Yeah, he's talking about the, yep.
And in that talk, he goes into this lesson that he does in his classroom where he tells the students, just write like crazy. And then he's running around the room, egging them on. Just keep writing. Don't think about it. Just keep writing. Just keep writing. And it's the metaphor he comes up with is you're running away from those devils, the devils inside you that say, "What for? Why do anything creative after all?" And then it's less. It's about sloppy writing, putting ideas on paper, but eventually it coaxes your brain into this pattern of being creative, right? But it's this fierce running to getting to those endorphins, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of idea. This is all I'm speaking metaphorically now. Mm-hmm. My classrooms, I would pitch any of these quests as what they're called, and I actually should adopt the language quest in my classroom. I call them warm-ups. Today's warm-up is this, and we're only spending 20 minutes on it. Mm. I'll have 15 kids in the room, and there'll always be two kids who do not make it. And it's why don't they make it? Because they're making it harder than it has to be, and they won't let go of just sloppily throwing ideas on paper. And I'll see them and I'll tell them, you know, it's like Jack Kirby said, you're paid to pencil, not erase. I don't want to see any erasers going, you don't like the way it's turning out? Scribble it out. I don't care. But you are not erasing. And then I'll still see that kid. But it's not right.
Does it count if I use the side of the eraser?
Yeah. And I try to, you know, cajole them and say like, well, just draw sloppy. I'm not at, and I even borrowed some language from another Lean Into Art instructor, Kim Holm. Where I heard him say to a classroom, I thought this was great. He said, like, if you draw too good, it's going to make me feel bad. You don't want me to feel bad, do you? You don't want me to feel like you guys are challenging me. So just draw as bad as you can. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the funny thing is it's tough to get somebody, especially if you want them to share the work with you, it's tough to get them to let that stuff be seen. And something I'm trying to model, like if anybody's been following my Google Plus feed, I post all these dumb little sketches I do in the Papyrus app on my Galaxy Note. They're not very good sketches. They're really sloppy. They're not very well thought out. I'm usually talking to somebody else while I'm doing them. It's nothing that I would put in a leather-bound sketchbook with gold embossed letters that says Jersey Drozd on it. But I'm trying to model this idea that, you know, sloppy drawing. This is how you get ideas on paper, right? What are you going to say?
I think, yeah, okay. It's so funny. Okay. There's like 10 different points that you were digging through there or that you laid out that I want to dig through where, okay. I probably would be one of the kids depending on the day. I would either be the first kid done or the last kid done. And so far with the quests, I've been the last kid done kind of kid. And, even when I challenged myself to be the first kid done kind of kid, but the, let's see, you're, let's, your sloppy drawings are pretty damn good. So that's all relative. So some other artists are going, you know, that's
yeah,
sloppy.
Yeah, well.
Then there's, let's see, the quest right size. We do make it a lot harder on ourselves. And that's where I think, well, what if, what if we try to accommodate for that? You know what I mean? It's like the quests aren't necessary because we're doing this as solo exercises. These aren't facilitated exercises. And again, I don't mean to harp on my hunch there, but there's no coach over our shoulder, right? When we're doing these, so that instant feedback loop.
What's we that? Should record a 20 minute audio loop of us going, "Come on, you can do it! I believe in you."
Exactly. That could be some kind of Maybe we'll come up with a bonus download for something.
A bonus download. You have to sign up for the mailing list to get, and it's just me and Rob cheering you on, punctuated by my laughter every 2 minutes. It could be great, or it could be nightmarish. We'll find out.
Yeah. It's like, exactly. Well, some strange, encouraging, and hopefully fun ambient music. Anyway, it's I really do wonder, because so far, 3 for 3, they've taken me hours.
Wow.
Yeah, 3 for 3.
Well, okay, but here's another thing. Okay, so just to be fair, you know, because I don't want to come off like I'm just blasting through these quests like this is nothing. We do make things harder for ourselves in a variety of ways. So, like, for instance, my quest that I got for submission for this week, I drew on my note, my Galaxy Note, in the Layer Paint app. Mm-hmm. And it took a little longer than it should have because I was using it as an opportunity to let's start practicing drawing and inking and coloring on this device, right? So I'm working in a medium that I am not used to. And I think that the medium counts. If it's a medium that you are not terribly used to, like say writing, for instance, I'm a slow writer. I'm a very slow writer when it comes to like typing out words to construct sentences, and I'm constantly re-editing on the fly, and I know I'm not supposed to do that. But so the medium makes a difference as to how comfortable you're in that medium, right? So it's not here's where I failed, or maybe a lesson learned in doing these quests is I shouldn't be using technologies or techniques that I'm not terribly comfortable with. Like when we talked about doing like the warm-up sketches in the past, it wasn't about breaking out a new pose or a new kind of style or character that I wasn't used to. It was do something you're absolutely comfortable with, and the only challenge is learning this new tool. I'm going to use this kind of pen. That's the only part of this that's going to suck. Everything else is going to be a breeze. So in the quests, you should be choosing a medium that is absolutely fluid to you. So if it's just a little notepad and a ballpoint pen, you know, mm-hmm. Guess what? If you turn in your quest on that, that's awesome. You turned in the quest. But we make it hard for ourselves because we also want to go watch everybody's gonna just groan with envy when they see this awesome thing that I drew, you know? And in the end, I wound up doing that very thing with the quest that I turned in. Like, I didn't finish it in Layer Paint. I finished it in Photoshop because A, I was crunched for time, and B, because I wanted it to look good. So I'm guilty of the same thing.
And let's see. Inherently, I think that's the meta exercise about quests. I don't think we can separate from that. And I don't think it's necessarily I just wonder if what we could do is part of how we create quests as quest givers, and others that we do invite on to at some point be quest givers. Just a little cat out of the bag there. We don't plan on being the only quest givers. Surprise.
We're the authorities. All knowledge stops here. This is the fountain you come to.
Exactly. Which is fun when you think about where I wrote a quest and it was like a horrible punishment on myself to get through it. And it was fun and in some ways, but it was also like, you know, all sorts of demons popping out of everywhere going like, you know, bet you didn't expect me.
But that is good food for thought though, because on the one hand, you don't want it to be too easy. Like draw 6 circles. Who wants to do that? There's nothing challenging about it. This is video game stuff, right? This is in your workshop making video games from comics. That the challenges have to get successful.
Successively.
Successively. Thank
or
you.
Or in succession, harder. The challenges can become.
Yes. But at the same time, they can't get too hard immediately, right? And if you're spending 20 minutes on the first level, you're going to throw the controller on the floor and give up on it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, in a great book, Ralph Koster, a theory of fun. He accredits that to our brains really enjoy demonstrating what we know while we're learning something new. So we had some portion of it has to be familiar while we're reaching into the unfamiliar. But if too much of that is reaching really far and so much of it's unfamiliar, it becomes noise because we can't match it to anything we know. And then those kinds of challenges are too hard. And anyway, I don't know. I don't think we've quite set up a dungeon of pain and sad mystery, but I do think the quests are a little hard. If I'm like learning the difficulty, it's like we've said, well, one of the things with when you make a game, you need to test it sometime, play it to know how hard it is, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is a little bit hard. just a little bit. We're like maybe anyway, and yet it's also factored on the player. The player is hugely part of adjusting the difficulty level, which, you know what, maybe that's part of the answer. Maybe part of how we publish quests is we remind people of that aspect. Make a few choices as you embark on this quest when you equip yourself, right? I mean, so if you're this is the mythical quest where you're picking up a shield and a backpack and a sword, it's going to be harder if you pick up weapons you're not familiar with, right?
Yeah. And
that kind of thing.
Right. I want to close this piece with Ivy Design. I believe that's Ben Ivy in the chat is asking, does recognizing your weaknesses make you work slower or harder? Recognizing your weaknesses. We were talking about a lot of different kinds of weaknesses here.
It's both for me. I mean, for me, and it's like, so in some ways I realize, oh, okay, I should adjust what I'm doing because I just experience the benefit of a feedback loop. And now I can take this observation and use it as a tool as I choose what I do next. And that helps me always. And, let's see. So I may end up saving myself some time, but also, yeah, I mean, getting thoughtful and observant takes more time.
Well, you more than I think sometimes model this philosophy of the very cast that we're doing right now is this kind of intentionality in one's creativity. Intentionality not only in terms of what I intend to create, but intentionality in terms of being reflective on what you've done and measuring it and looking at what was the outcome, what was the intent. Where did I go wrong? Where did I go right? Let's adjust. Let's course correct on this thing. Anyway, good curveball, Rob. That was a big one. That was a lot of things for me to chomp on as I think about my next quest to throw down. Mm-hmm. So with that, and without any musical fanfare transition segue kind of stuff, we'll get into the 1,000 feet up main topic because the quest hijacked the episode for this week or this bye week. In that, you know, the more we got to thinking about it, the more we realized that, yeah, you know, I think that should be the whole hour is talking about not just reviewing the quest, but sort of like what topics spin out of doing this quest, right? Mm-hmm. Let me pull up my outline here. So making as I was working on mine, you can find mine at it's on Google Plus, and that's at google.com/plus/jerseydrozd. When did I post it? What is today?
11:48 a.m. The 28th of February.
February 28th, and you could just search for Gallows Wither is the name of the character that I did. So as I was writing the character's bio and explaining where she charts, it got me thinking about a lot of different stuff in terms of what I'm struggling with whenever I'm writing characters and creating characters, and that's what this villain exercise is all about. Is by looking at a character, right? What this goes back to some talk we did in past episodes about in that Transformers episode, Burden Hardest to Bear. One cannot think of victory without also considering its opposite, defeat. Right? You think of something smells good, that means something smells bad, right? So you think of a villain, and I think this is something you were going to bring to this too, is like you think of the opposite of the villain, mm-hmm. protagonist, hero, whatever you want to call him, right?
And for me, as I was going through my exercise, I focused mostly on the writing and on just actually immersing myself into the categories of the villain that it's almost I feel like I did a little bit of a I remember Rob back in high school would get an assignment and interpret the assignment. I feel like I interpreted it a little bit, and I really stuck with pure only the writing, and I was super fascinated and really into trying to figure out these different distinctions because I hadn't chewed on them that much before. And then realizing, you know, a couple of things that fall out of that where, okay, this villain was a couple of different categories. So yeah, my post on the LeahQuest 3 evil or just a jerk is at, agz.me/interactive storyteller. And, anyway, I was, let's see it as I realized, well, wow, this bad guy was a few different categories of bad guy. And then I had only considered the hero's journey, but the bad guy has a journey too. It's like a shadow of the hero's journey, you know? And it's just like, why didn't I think of this before kind of stuff. So anyway,
yeah,
there's this intertwined.
And when we say bad guys, by the way, just for those who are kind of going like, what are these guys talking about? Quests, evil or just a jerk. So yeah, we had a quest that we launched with this 2 episodes ago where we were challenging the leaners. And if you're a new listener to the show, thanks for downloading. Take on this quest where you evaluate some of your favorite bad guy characters or gals. When I say bad guy, I mean anybody who's a troublemaker in a story, anybody who's an antagonist, anybody who causes problems in the story for the hero or protagonist. Not that those things are the same, but they, you know, they're generally in the same ballpark. Causes trouble for those two types of characters. And I put up an arbitrary or rather haphazard list of categories, and the challenge was to assign your favorite characters to these different categories and be prepared to explain why. And then the heroic challenge was design your own villain or bad guy or stinker or whatever and assign them to one of those chartings, one of those different categories that I came up with years ago. So yeah, Rob, you did that. You did the regular quest where mm-hmm. you assigned some of your favorite characters to different categories and explained why. I went the other way. I did the character design. And then we had some pieces submitted by leaners. We had Inkbot's Brainscape is one. These will be linked in the show notes, by the way. Mm-hmm. Inkbot's – it's Luke or Luzik, luzeke.tumblr.com is one of them. And then the other one is on DeviantArt, and that's weahoo.deviantart.com, and that's Control Alt Lee on Twitter. Quest 3, evil or just a jerk. It's W E.
Yeah, each of these. So, Inkbot's post was fascinating, and that was honestly, I thought, oh, that's a really good model to begin. Where I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to just start to maybe profile these different, you know, antagonists or what have you, and. Mm-hmm. It was just fun food for thought, and this is a wonderful analysis of a variety of kinds of characters, ranging from things that I haven't come across, like this wild alien from Atomic Robo, the Shadow from Beyond Time, cool idea for a character, to like Nightmare Moon from My Little Pony: Friendship is Magic.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and of course Shredder, which I never saw the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from 2003.
I've only seen bits of it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Utrum's Shredder. But yeah, we'll link to these in the show notes for folks to follow up on after the fact. But I want to get a little abstract for a second. This is the 10,000 feet up section, and I want to talk about some things that. I think are worth investigating when coming up with a character. So we talk about this analysis of stuff. We'll go into that a little bit more in a minute here. But as I was building my character, I realized that there were three things that I was struggling with when I say struggle, I don't mean that like, oh, I'm not going to be able to beat this, but these are the three struggles I go through with virtually every character I come up with, and I'm doing this a lot in this graphic novel treatment that I'm working on, is visual interest. How do you create somebody that looks visually appealing, right? Character internal truth and character thematic truth. And these are recent phrasings that I came up with based on classroom discussions, because I kept talking about what is the character's role and what is their function. And I think that got a little confusing sometimes, like what role do they perform in the story and then what function do they perform in the story. But I think if you think about a character from a sense of an internal truth, what is the truth that they live in? Like, what is the truth that they've told themselves? What is the truth of what's the truth they told themselves, and what's the truth that exists in the story as in terms of plot?
Is that similar to what is their worldview in a way, or what's their general perspective?
That's part of it. Their perspective is part of it, but then there's also the narrative perspective, right? Because you, the author, are going to have a bias as the storyteller here, right? Mm-hmm. And so a character can have a perspective that you don't agree with, and you're showing that they're wrong in their perspective, right? Especially if you're writing that kind of dramatica, grand argument theory of storytelling, mm-hmm. which not everybody necessarily should. But I'm just saying that it's a great example to look at because it's so vivid in its contrasts. But then character thematic truth is, what does the character's role in the story ultimately express in the theme of your story? Good guy or bad guy, right? They should be expressing some kind of central idea of the story, the beating heart of the story. And you, I think, very astutely were picking up on something about how this ties into the Pixar's 22 rules of phenomenal storytelling.
Oh, and exactly. Reading through your show notes, it reminded me honestly, it reminded me of something that I noticed because of a weakness I have in writing that I've, trying to exercise through and practice and get better at, which is to just nullify certain perspectives from my characters. And all it just sort of this, like, I'm this ultimate censor who's just saying, nope, not going to share that in the story. I think it doesn't directly come through, but I think it feels through in the writing. So anyway, you can tell something's missing from a character if they're not willing to, for instance, and I think this is the better way to put it, the Pixar's, I'll just read these three things to see if this helps exemplify. So they have I've seen this post travel around a few different times, Pixar's 22 rules of storytelling. And there's a few that stand out to me for different reasons. And it was actually on my mind recently because of Daniel H. Pink's book, To Sell as Human, which I'm still reflecting on it. And and I know it's totally off topic, but he mentions one of the Pixar rules in his book actually quite a bit. Not these though. So as far as getting that some kind of truth out of your character and having them ring true, so number 13 is give your characters opinions. Passive and malleable might seem likable as you write, but it's poison to the audience. Number 14, mm-hmm. why must you tell this story? What's the belief burning within you that your story feeds off of? That's the heart of it, which I'm guessing probably feeds into your themes. Number 15, if you were your character in this situation, how would you feel? Honesty lends credibility to unbelievable situations.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is why Pixar films, we can watch a movie about an old man in a house with a bunch of balloons tied to it floating around, and we can get emotionally invested in that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're observing these kinds of rules. I would classify these under suggestions, but I think they're really good suggestions. Why must you tell this story? That's theme. What's the thing? What's the point you're trying to make? What are you opinionated about? And what argument are you trying to present for the world, right? I once saw years ago some people in a stupid internet fight. Now, and this may sound funny coming from me as the guy who like plays Mr. Nice Guy whenever he's online or tries to, but there were some people having an internet fight about something that they both felt very strongly about, and I was watching the fight unfold, reading all the comments, and somebody kind of got involved, somebody new to the discussion came in and said, look, I don't know much about any of the things that you guys are talking about, but it just seems to me, and everybody shouted that person out, they're like, then get out of here. If you don't know anything about it, and if you don't have any skin in the game, let the big boys play. And I think that was the language somebody used, and I remember thinking like, ooh, that was harsh. That was really rough. They didn't have to do that to that poor guy. But as I think about it, I'm like, yeah, you know, that person didn't have an opinion yet. And they got involved before they were ready to argue over the thing, right? What's chewing at you? And I think that that's kind of a good place to work from when you're writing something, right? You yourself have written from past observations and memories and somewhat painful or more poignant experiences, right?
Once in a while, I pull it off. once in a while, yeah. And it's an example of having following some rules or listening to some advice and guidelines and getting and building up a taste where somehow you can sense it, and then that's the tool to be able to do this. When you're like, oh, okay, I can tell I didn't really say what I felt because I notice it missing, right?
But these three rules really feed into each other really well. It's like also give the characters opinions, give them a point of view, and have them actually either believe in it or they've deceived themselves into it. But for whatever reason, from their vantage point in the story, this is how they express their point of view, right? And then inhabit that character. When you throw in the twist, when you throw in the switcheroo that changes their perspective, how do they react to that thing? Get inside of them and figure that out. Figure out how you would react to that, from the point of view of that character as well, right? I mean, this is the stuff that I really wrangle with. I don't just try to design somebody who looks cool. I'm trying to design somebody who feels truthful. And truthful in the sense of not that they don't lie, but truthful in the sense that everything that comes out of them has an inner consistency, an internal logic to it. Everybody talks about this constantly
convicting themselves like, I'm a big dumb guy. I'm just a bully. You know, bullies suck. You know, they're whole people. They believe what they're doing is correct, and they believe it for a reason, and they got there for a reason. They're making choices, and if you get to participate or see those choices play out, that feels real. If they have that kind of consistency to them as a
right,
yeah.
Get your drinking glass. There's a phrase you said,
Jersey. I'm trying to dig up. Can you help me with that? That has to do with what writing your characters with, true love?
Writing characters with perfect love.
Perfect love. Okay, there you go.
I borrowed that from Campbell. Okay. Right. And so, yeah, perfection is anything but lovable. And then he says, you look at the Buddhas, they're all perfect. We don't look at the image of the Buddha or the Christ image and go, oh, he's so huggable. You know? That would be irreverent to do something like that, right? Mm-hmm. What's lovable about a person is what's wrong with them. And you should name – and this is – oh, man, I was just – who was I talking about this? It was on a recent Comics Are Great show, as a matter of fact. It hasn't dropped in the podcast feed yet, but it is on YouTube. I believe it was episode 73 with Chris Straub, and we talked about the difference between dumping on something and making a loving parody of it, right? And I think the example he used was Christopher Guest of Spinal Tap. Right? This is Spinal Tap. And then he did that other one. Is it Inherit the Wind? Is that what it's called? Mm. One about folk music. Okay. And he was being interviewed by somebody who said, boy, it was really great how you just lambasted folk music because it's so terrible, right? And he said, no, I love folk music. It's like, that's why I made this film. And Straub, I think, very, very keenly pointed out that if you're going to do a parody, you should love it's helpful to love the thing you're making a parody of because you're familiar with it. You know what the faults are, and you can name those faults with love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Um, So I think the same kind of thinking should hold true in the characters that you write. Is like, I try not to create characters that are there to be booed. They're not there for us to yell at them. And like, I remember writing this in my notebook, 12, 15 years ago. It's like, the bad guys should be just as lovable as the good guys, because that's a way more fun to read. Even if the bad guys are wrong, even if their point of view is flawed, I should do my best to make them as appealing to an audience, so they're not just there to be. I guess it depends on the story, because I mean, if you're doing something about zombies, you don't want zombies to be as lovable as the heroes.
Well, they should matter, right? It's hard to matter. If they don't resonate in any way, then they won't matter. They have to. Actually, I just recently started watching The Walking Dead. That would be an interesting thing to try to analyze, is a different kind of bad guy. Cause I guess all of this was one of the things I super duper love about this quest you set up, is that we are thinking deeply about the opposite side of the coin, that we don't always just, love and worship and celebrate. You know, we always talk about the bad guys aren't always the main characters in a story. I'm really curious, actually. I noticed, let's see, what was it? Renee Van Belzen via Twitter tweeted to me when I posted, my version, my attempt on the quest, about the book Wicked, right? Where it's a sent. I haven't read that yet, but that sounds like it's an example of, well, obviously it's the book is about the character of the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz, but it's from her perspective, I think. And yeah. Have you read this book?
Well, I have not, but I mean, this is the Rashomon thing, right? The Kurosawa film where you see the same crime from three different points of view, from the point of view of the person who commits the crime, the victim, and then an onlooker. Right. Sure.
That also happened in Sonic Adventure, the one. Yeah. But I love that.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then there's the Audrey Tautou film, He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not, where it's a romance story that's told from two different perspectives. And when you see it from one perspective, it appears to be this romance story about a man cheating on his wife with a young woman. And then you look at it from the other perspective and it becomes this very strange thing where all the evidence was there. But when you look at it from a different perspective, all of a sudden it takes on this nightmarish quality. I was really disturbed by that movie.
Yeah. I'm curious now. That is so, again, like that's one of the, that was such a fun aspect of this exercise. And here come the endorphins, right? So not to totally come back, tie it back to the curveball, but then that's what can get so immersive about a quest, where it's like, oh wow, I just, I'm figuring out this thing and it's so cool. I want to learn more about it.
You're cracking the code, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Or at least becoming conversant enough to know that there's a code.
Yeah, there we go. I think that's a good way of putting it.
So
yeah, and I don't know if that movie's on Netflix or not, but I'll link to it in the show notes, at least the IMDb profile, if he loves me, he loves me not. So two questions I ask myself when trying to discover the character's inner truth. Or, well, actually, let's stay on thematic truth just for a moment, because we were talking a little bit about this idea of, like, what's eating at you? I'm going to point people at an old Thunder Punch Daily I did, episode 6. I can't believe it was that old when I looked it up. Argue for your theme, where I spend a good 20 minutes talking about this idea of lining up your characters, coming with a central argument of the story. This is the point I'm trying to make. Let's figure out pros and cons. This is that old rhetorical or rhetoric premise of you should be able to argue both sides of a point kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. That's part of the whole rhetorical education path is arguing all sorts of different kinds of things. And let's like presenting a worshipful speech, presenting a hateful speech, present all these different. Yeah.
Yeah. And being able to, like logically break down an argument. Mm-hmm. So I try to do that with my stories. I'm like, okay, here's the central idea. Here's the point I'm going to try to make. All right, now I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to stand on the other side and say why that's wrong. And then I'm going to go back on the other side and say why that's right. Now I've got the framework of an argument. Now I'm going to populate this argument with characters who are going to represent different aspects of those different sides of the argument. And if you think about the different sides occurring along a spectrum where there's people who are kind of more towards the neutral ground or maybe a little bit more towards the con, a little bit more towards the pro, and then you can start populating your characters in there, and that gives you a reference point to start building them into characters with a point of view, which builds into your thematic premise. Then you inhabit those characters. That leads me back to the character internal truth. And the next question I ask is, what is the story the character tells himself? What is this character's worldview in terms of, if you were to walk up to them today and say, tell me about yourself, they'd say, well, I'm a person who does this. Not their job, but I'm a character who represents this in life. And you could do this to anybody. You say, like, what do you stand for? Right? And people are going to tell you one thing. But there's inconsistencies in there. There's contradictions in us because we're human beings after all. And that leads to my second question, which is, does the story they tell themselves differ from the narrative truth of the character, the truth that you, the omnipotent and omniscient writer, know about them? It doesn't have to, but does it, right?
Would it, like, I'm guessing that a lot of stories probably start with the character having a different perspective of their true or unactualized nature versus and where they're currently at before they realize it. So I'm guessing they those two things probably get woven closer and closer together as the or go further and closer together as the story goes on until they become, you know, right, actualized. And
well, unless you write one-dimensional characters like I do. You know, I've been known to populate some of my stories with characters who are just there to be that guy, you know, but they're there to represent a thematic element, a piece of the argument. But, you know, there are characters that I've put in stories because, like, they're not there to grow. They're there to assist. They're there to act as supporting cast. They don't come out loudly changed or, you know, vibrantly changed. Maybe changed, but anyway, I just don't want anybody to walk away with the impression that I'm writing every character as being like this great work of the great American novel. But yeah,
I'm certainly presumably not. But I still like to go on these exercises and get better at it.
But while I was working on Gallows Wither, these were the questions I was wrestling with: is what does she tell herself, and what does she discover about herself? There's another way of putting it. So,
what was the?
Go ahead.
I don't know if this is diving too much into the, you know, getting on the ground, but I skimmed it. I got distracted by the beautiful rendering of the character.
Nicely put.
And a lack of time.
Rob.
What's that?
I said very diplomatically put.
And no, and it's true. And when crunch for time, and I'm reading an article, I look at the pictures. So, yeah. But okay. So what was it that you took away from the experience of creating Willows? Like, what did she realize? And did that ring true to you then? Did you pull it off?
Yeah. Well, I realized. And actually, here's a chief benefit I got from doing the quest is this is all stuff I've been working on for months with this character, but I was working on it up here. I was sketching her on my notes, you know, in my notebooks and everything, maybe making a few little chicken scratch things. Like, maybe she could do this, maybe she could do that, maybe she'd be called this, called that. But I wasn't writing out any of her biography. I had a general idea. I had this fuzzy, shadowy squint test version of her bio written in my head, but I didn't put it on paper. And it wasn't until I put it on paper and started to have that conversation with myself that it started to congeal. And here's all I knew when I started was that she was a spirit creature who represents this family who are all aspects of hatred. Hatred is the family name, and each member of the family is one particular negative emotion that engenders hatred, right? And there's 500 kids in the family. And the mother is gone. Mother's not there. But the kids are all left running around on the planet being evil spirits. And all I knew was that she was going to be operating on her own. She wasn't doing what mom wanted because mom hasn't been around for a long time. And then mom comes back and something bad happens. That's all I had worked out. And then when I started writing it and thinking really, you know, like aloud about it, I realized that, well, this, the story she's telling herself is she doesn't need mom. She's on her own. And I'm going to be the greedy child who tries to hoard things for myself. I've got this power. I've got this ability. I'm just going to start, you know, building up a little place for myself. Mom comes back. Is mom going to punish her for that? Or is mom going to be happy with her? What is the revelation that occurs when mom comes back? And then it dawned on me that this is an opportunity to say, daughter, you are not operating on your own. This was all part of my deal. I'm a godlike creature after all. This is preordained. This is written. You think you're acting out of your own volition, but you're not. This was my doing. Come back to mother. Pulls her back. And so this creature who represents hopelessness and is trying to engender hopelessness in the world gets pulled back to her mother to confront her own hellish hopelessness, because she ultimately discovers that she's not her own. She has no agency of her own, right?
Her power yeah, gets exactly. turned. I'm like, wow, that oofta.
So the poetry that I was trying to get at here is that this is what poetry, Rod Serling-esque irony, perhaps, is that the thing she's trying, that she does so well to others, gets turned upon her, because ultimately, like a theme I like to express in my stories is that evil breaks its own tools, and there's always a bigger evil, and no matter how nasty you think you are, there's something way worse than you that's even more terrifying than you are. So there's no point in being the big bully on the block, because there's just going to be a bigger bully. So you might as well be a good guy. Good guy nihilism 101. But anyway, so what did I discover about asking those questions was that it found me some interesting thematic points, and it found me an interesting ending to the character. And I just spoiled one of the endings to the book. But, it's probably going to change between now and when the book finally sees print, because once editors get involved and everything. But did that even come close to answering your question?
I think that totally explains that explains her arc. I think it did, because what I was curious about is did you accomplish what you set out to with that intent of getting that difficult to attain thing, that truth. That she's representing.
And I'm intentionally being a little opaque here, because I don't want to just dump everything that I have written down about the story out there for a variety of reasons, both time and also I don't want to spoil the story, and I don't want to spoil the story's energy for myself while I'm still really excited about it. And I want to get it on paper and commit to it in a pitch before I start telling anybody else about these ideas. But totally, it also it became a lovely negative inflection of a positive theme I wanted to express in the story. But that's for another time. When I finish the pitch, I can talk about it. But anyway, we didn't talk about visual interest all that much. Maybe this is the time to go on the ground and hit some of these tools and techniques. Mm-hmm. Wait a second here. Yeah, your own thoughts and wonderings that I wanted to get to when we go to categorizing your characters.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's see. As far as categorizing the characters, which was again the big part of the exercise that I just ended up getting lost in and enjoying being lost in it, because I don't know, I wasn't lost in noise and getting frustrated. I was becoming more conversant with just different distinctions of these of villains than before. And I wanted to make sure I tried to cover these different bases. And I thought, oh, okay. I'm going to, let's see, who did I start with? I didn't start with, Shin Natsume from, Tenchō Tenge. I might have started with I think Clarice from Percy Jackson and the Olympians, because
I didn't know you were a fan of that book.
A huge fan of that book.
Wow.
Yeah. I've heard the audiobooks because I consume a lot of my books via audiobooks, or comics. And, wow. That series I've listened to straight through, I don't know how many times. So It anyway, wow. she's a very interesting character because she seems so menacing and she's tough, no question, right? But it was fun that you had the spectrum that included the category of just a jerk, because you truly have like horrific, awful, just, you know, like thinking of characters and the feelings and the experiences that they can convey as being either straight up comedic or like, this is the worst thing imaginable. But then this extra category of also jerks. Because jerks, they could be good as anything or bad as anything, but they just rub you the wrong way. And and that was fun to think about that and start with her. And then, but I quickly ended up thinking about Shin Natsume, which is a character that has just fascinated me ever since I'd first watched the anime series Tenchou Tenge, which he represents sympathy for the devil. Like, I've never had a character that was that bad that I cared about. But him, I mean, he's amazingly complex. And then I was going through your categories that you said are haphazard, which I say pshaw, because I think they're quite durable. Sure, you know, we could add more, but I think it's a great, a great spectrum where, you know, on one end you go from megalomaniac to madness to revenge to for greater good, because bad guys could be doing something that they believe is for the greater good that's just hurting everyone else, that they just don't care about that as much. Force of nature, you know, perhaps sometimes Hulk smash, perhaps sometimes, you know, Godzilla step, sociopath, super, you know, and dark inertia is where things get really bad. And I said, and it was with and then of course just a jerk, where Shin Natsume was, I was like, oh my god, he was so many of these categories in the story. And that to me, just again, like this aha I had of like, okay, villains go through their own path that is, there's got to be a shadow. My hypothesis is that there's a shadow journey to the hero's journey. I have not fully chewed that out, but it seems like that would be a reasonable, the tension on the other side and the constant contrast between, because when the hero benefits, the villain is, you know, hurt in some way or shape or form. And then the opposite's true. So anyway, their sort of positive negative polarity constantly plays off one another.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be that binary either, because it could be that, a drum I like to beat on is that not every story has to end well. It just has to end in a satisfactory manner. Mm. And the villain doesn't have to become good and doesn't have to die. But as long as they go through some kind of path, right, that makes us feel satisfied. The example I always think of is the proposed original ending to that Robin Williams movie, What Dreams May Come. And if anybody's seen the movie, the one that went to theaters. What's that?
I have. It's been ages. That's where they had a really painterly animated style on top of live action.
Yeah, his wife dies. Mm-hmm. She kills her. Or no, he dies. And he goes into the afterlife and he's sort of like visiting her through her paintings, although she can't see him. He's eventually trying to like move on to the real afterlife with his little helper guardian creatures, and eventually finds out that his wife committed suicide. And when you commit suicide, you go to hell, and there's no way out. And he's like, well, I got to go help her. And so he goes on this quest to find his wife, finds her in hell. But the problem is that just being in hell rips you of all of your identity and hope and all anything positive about you, and eventually just drives you into like this kind of comatose state. And in the released film, he starts to go under. He starts to succumb to the horrors of hell, and then his wife comes out of it and says, "Like, no, you're falling under the influence of hell. Let's get out of here together." And then they both go home, and then they're like dancing around in the field with their two dead kids and their dead dog. Supposedly in the original version, he just falls into the state of hell with his wife, and that's where they stay. Mm-hmm. Which I felt like, what a lovely idea that he loves her so much he would endure hell forever for her. But audiences didn't like it, not happy. And so that's an example I like to point out to say, like, well, there's a difference between happy and satisfying, right?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that's a sidetrack there. But I do love this idea of characters, yeah, a villain who's not just there to be a character to be booed and hissed at, but a character who can undergo a transformation and an evolution. Because I'm sure that Shin Natsumi, I haven't read this or seen this, but I'm sure he's not madness, revenge, greater good, force of nature, sociopath, or dark inertia all at the same time in the story.
No, I mean, he oscillates between these different things as in almost in response to the things in the environment and his own internal issues, which that story isn't primarily from his perspective. So you don't fully follow that, but you get his journey in these glimpses from the perspectives of the other characters that are going through dealing with his essential downfall. Right. And his downfall happens in essentially in a flashback arc. So it's a whole giant curveball in the series, but I don't want to share any spoilers. But you get the idea pretty early on that whatever things went really poorly with the Natsume sister's older brother Shin, and he also comes back and loves and cares and tries to help and is almost a Yoda figure at certain points. Because his power that pulled him down was the Dragon's Eye. His youngest sister has it too, and that's cool. I mean, he's able to have lucid, genuine, caring conversation and helps, like just bad guy helping. That's awesome to me, and incredibly complex. That it makes that story so much more interesting.
Yeah. Well, this is like, writing your characters as people, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's basically that whoever wrote Shin had to have really loved Shin. And like, cause he was really bad. Like Shin is bad, bad, bad. He did bad stuff. Like really bad. And that, to say like someone capable of so much bad is also capable of other things and has a more complete existence internally and with others in the world, that's
writing with compassion is what it is, right? This idea of the warrior enters the battlefield as if you were attending a funeral, because if you think of your opponents as monsters, you're dehumanizing yourself. And so like having a sense of compassion that this is another person that I'm dealing with here, and
exactly,
we should be treating the characters that we create as people. Not to drive ourselves up a wall and suddenly say like, oh, this is that, what was that movie? Stranger Than Fiction, where we're writing a real person's life or anything like that.
Okay.
That was that Will Ferrell movie where he finds out that he's a character in a book.
Oh, I've heard it. Okay. I don't know. Was it good?
I don't usually go in for Will Ferrell movies, but I liked this one a lot. It had a lot of really interesting visual storytelling.
You must have been where I heard about it.
Yeah, and he discovers that he's a character in a book, and he's living in the same world as the author of the book. So it gets weird. It gets really weird, and like he goes in quest of finding his author, and finding out what to do about it. Right. But I don't normally find his films all that funny, but that particular movie wasn't funny. It was more of like a kind of a off-kilter drama, and I love Dustin Hoffman's character in it, and that's another actor I don't really care for most of the time, but I loved his character in that because he's just so crazy about storytelling, even if he's not really saying anything terribly smart about storytelling. Mm-hmm. So it looks like it was a good intellectual journey for you to go on. So I'm looking through this, and then you even chose some of your own characters. Good for you.
Yeah, that was my sort of attempt at interpreting the next level of the quest and just trying to see if how I could map three different characters that are toward the antagonist side in one of my stories. Where would they fit in this? And
Cool that you got a greater good in there too. Because I think Megalomaniac is an easy one to default to. And, I mean, heck, I have mine set to Megalomaniac, but...
Those are fun. But I mean, Megalomaniacs can be essentially clowns with knives, right? I mean, they're dangerous, but they can be funny and...
So I'm also looking at Lucas Haig's. Is it Haig or Hag? There's an umlaut over the A, and I don't know how to pronounce that. I'm sorry, Lucas, if I'm mispronouncing this. Again, this is at Inkbot or Luke Luzik, luzeke.tumblr.com, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But he went the whole way. Not only did he categorize a bunch of characters, he created a character, created a villain, Resimir. Look at that cool design. Gives me a little bit of a One Piece kind of vibe, that kind of cool exaggeration style to him. But I love the kind of the effects he did on the magic around the character's hand, all that painterly effect.
Oh, totally! It's like
the
particle cloud,
the nice, energetic, flourishy pose for this guy. And when he says madness, madness and megalomaniac, yeah, you can see it on the design. But then he goes in and he does some power-ups. He went ahead and did power-ups too. So he takes the cake for this quest.
He does.
He does all.
Nice work.
He brings up a terrific – now we're on the ground, whether we like it or not, because we're talking about actual tools to assist you in this kind of stuff. He talks about the Pathfinder and Shadowrun 4E core rule books for GURPS. Those were GURPS, right?
I believe so. I never played GURPS. Check the books out once in a while. So yeah, it's the generic universal role playing system.
Yeah,
I believe. And honestly, I mean, that's another. It is like another framework style way to look at storytelling. Is role playing systems are going to have something critical to the success of people having fun is having some, you know, way of working together with characters that have something interesting to them. That then you're playing off one another. So role-playing systems are trying to weave together, you know, a bunch of storytellers all jamming. So makes sense that they would be good resources, actually.
Yeah, actually. I mean, just for reading alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's at least my way of intellectually justifying it is these source books or core rule books are providing a framework for an internal logic for a place where stories can happen. Right.
Totally.
So it's a way to coax your mind into thinking about how do the rules work of the world in which I'm building, if there are any, right? And
sure.
There should be some
super
kind
of deep framework. So yeah, not just the characters. I mean, the whole world and other conceits and yeah.
Both. Yeah, and it like I remember when I was reading the Robotech Palladium supplements. And I learned the difference between structural damage capacity, SDC, and then mega damage capacity, MDC. Because I figured, well, a Veritech would just have like 1,000 SDC. It would just have like 1,000,000 SDC. It would take like so much. But then it pointed out that, well, no. Because these things are made of like this really crazy metal, this dense alloy that if you're throwing – you could throw pebbles at it all day, which could chip away like, you know, 0.5 SDC. It won't do anything. It'll scratch the paint. It won't even dent it after a while. Whereas, so you have to have like a certain threshold of attack power in order to hurt the thing. And that's where mega damage capacity comes in. It was a whole new way to think about how damage works in storytelling, right? The dumb thing. But I remember it being a real light bulb moment for me. Wow, structural damage capacity, mega damage capacity. But then Lucas also points at Jonathan Rector's Megacosm video, which something that I'm not sure if we've ever mentioned on the show before, but the Scribbles with Jonathan YouTube series is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Excellent resource.
So he says in this particular video, which we'll link to in the show notes, Jonathan shows a video of himself drawing up a villain and talking a bit about his thoughts and processes around it. It's a good video to watch for inspiration. So, Lucas, you are the hero of today with your post.
I do want to give a proper shout out as well to again. I'm sorry. Who it's username Weahoo on DeviantArt.
Weahoo at DeviantArt, but that's Control Alt Lee on Twitter.
Control Alt Lee. Okay, thank you. I knew it was someone that was more familiar than handle I recognize, but versus this one. So all right. this is what I love about this is that, I mean, it's the whole infographic treatment.
Yeah.
I mean, this is essentially a meme attempt at the whole quest, which I think totally rocks. And again, an example of how we make things harder on ourselves than aren't we necessarily we need to just go get the benefit of doing the exercise, right? I mean, do you need to run 20 miles or is running, you know, 2 miles gonna be all right for today?
Right.
Probably depends on what you're training for, I guess. But anyway, I love that. I love this treatment of it.
Yeah, it is. It's really awesome. And then he's got some great examples in here. Cruella De Vil, hadn't even thought about her. HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey, as force of nature. Not having an evil intent as such, this character is often an expression of the repercussions of mankind screwing something up. Mm-hmm. HAL 9000 is a perfect example of that. I'm always, whenever I talk about force of nature, I always talk about like Jason Voorhees, zombies, you know. But man, I'm totally putting that one in my pocket for future classroom discussions.
Exactly. Yeah, totally love the twist. It's, you know, exactly going the high concept and technology route. Okay.
And then he puts in his own bad guy character, Joseph Steinhertz, an internet con man fighting what he thinks is the Illuminati shadow government uses ethically dubious methods. And this is a greater good character. A hallmark of the greater good character is that they believe in their cause so much that they'll do anything, any terrible thing, in order to see it through. Because, after all, the greater good justifies any action, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, good on you, Lee. Control-Alt-Lee on Twitter. Weahoo.deviantart.com. W-E-E-A. And who as in who? You. DeviantArt.com. It'll be linked in the show notes as well. But yeah, I think bonus points to Lee for doing the infographic and including the Lean Into Art logo in there.
Yeah, that's fun. Awesome job.
Yeah, super awesome job. So let's go into on the ground kind of things where for people who want to take this stuff to the next level. We didn't get to talk a lot about building visual interest in your characters, but I've got some resources to take people there.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I think that would be a great takeaway, a great way to hit the ground, because I mean, by its very nature, so much of this was the thinking aspect, right? And so, mm-hmm. I don't know, it makes sense to me to, yeah. What are some of these awesome resources you have, Jersey?
The first one I've got is a comic, an info comic called Draw Like a Ralph from the First Second blog. And I posted this on the Lean Into Art Tumblr. For those who don't know, Lean Into Art does have a Tumblr. It's leanintoart.tumblr.com. But this will be linked in the show notes. But it's this great comic where the cartoonist walks you through his thoughts on character design and building visual interest, working on negative space, thinking about the silhouette, thinking about how shape works into it. What are you laughing at?
No, I remember this one. I saw this post before, and because I'm like, that sounds really familiar. But yeah, okay. Anyway, and it's funny, and it's done in, it's a tutorial done in comic style.
Yeah,
which I love.
It's really great. It's really great. So it's like a 5 minute read, but it's got 40 pounds. This is one of the great things about comics, everybody, is that it's a 5 minute read that has a full like week's worth of tutorials inside of it. So visually and instructionally dense. Great. I would also point people at fellow Lean Into Art instructor Krishna Sadasivam's art blog, and that's at krishnas.tumblr.com. He is always posting interesting stuff on there about character design, about showing all of his process and procedure. You know, like there was a couple weeks ago, he was drawing the Thing from Fantastic Four, and he was doing all of the layers of processes. Here's the root, the rough, crude sketch, sloppy drawings. Everybody, we talked about this at the top, and then he shows like the more refined sketch, and then here's the inks, here's the colors. But he also shows one post in particular I'll link to in the show notes. He will start with silhouettes of characters, and then he goes into Photoshop with the transform tool and starts stretching them around. To exaggerate different parts of the body, right? And that's part of the kind of stylization we have at our disposal in cartooning, especially in cartooning, is, shape variation and exaggeration. That's something Krishna is always doing on his blog. It's great to read. And then the last one I have today is, this is a great source of ongoing inspiration, is Project Rooftop. Have you ever visited this site, Rob?
It sounds familiar. Let me see. But no, tell me about it.
Project Rooftop is spearheaded by cartoonist Dean Tripp and a writer. I forget the writer's name, but it's at 10centticker.com/Project Rooftop. And the premise is you redesign costumes of well-known superhero characters, right? Project Rooftop. Get it? Rooftop superhero characters.
Okay.
But what I like about this is, A, it can be a great source of inspiration because you're looking at a whole bunch of different reinterpretations of characters. But the big idea for me was – oh, and the other nice thing is with each post, the writers of the website and some other people come in to critique the design. They actually give it a score, and they give like thoughtful paragraphs about why they gave it that score, what they liked, what they didn't like. So you're not only seeing a bunch of cool designs, but you're getting to read some thoughtful critiques of the designs. So anyway, so the big idea that I was walking away with is reinvestigating existing characters is a really interesting exercise because it forces you to decode what the truth of that character is, right? So the example I put in the notes here is like, if you come at it and say, wouldn't it be cool if I redid Dragon Ball Z and gave Goku a chainsaw hand? Wouldn't that be cool? You know, well, does that say anything about Goku as a character? Does that reflect anything that was inherently truthful about that character, the character's, you know, thematic truth or inner truth? Why would you do that except because it's cool? I once knew a kid who used big words incorrectly all the time, and I would say, why would you do that? You know, and he says, because it sounds cool. Well, that's not a very good reason. You know? You're just making yourself sound silly when you do that. You know, it's like the old argument about like whether Batman, you know, I'm going to write Batman, but he kills. Well, you just violated something that's inherently truthful about Batman. I'm going to do Batman with machine guns. Well, now you really broke the character, right? By looking at the character and trying to work with what is truthful about them and then reinvestigate or redesign it from scratch, I think that's a really interesting, potentially fun, and very thoughtful exercise. You had a tip too.
For me, it was, this analysis and looking at it as largely a writing exercise and really trying to capture into words, like, and with this categorization of the different antagonists I was looking at and how they fit, it reminded me of the huge writing aspect of it too, and one way to help. Well, one thing I've been working on lately, or as a way to practice writing, is this, well, writing practice style thing, where I take 5 to 15 minutes, and I try to write 700 words, and it's my interpretation of the exercise that Natalie Goldberg talks about in Writing Down the Bones. And a huge conceit of the exercise is to just move your hands and write. Don't stop writing. And it's a weird position to put yourself in, because how often, well, and I mean, in conversation, would you just never stop? Or how often have you ever written anything completely just as a freight train and just with nonstop? It's not a typical thing, because we pause naturally and we take a breath but I think a lot of what we do is we edit, and we edit the heck out of things we say, especially when we're writing. And that's against the point of this. The point of this is to outpace the editor. Don't let the editor catch up. And by doing that, all of a sudden you're saying weird stuff that you wouldn't normally necessarily be saying, like a person who stays up way past their normal bedtime. You're off and running, sharing more than you would normally share.
I think that's great, though. I mean, I bet you've found some serious benefits and insights into what you gravitate towards in your writing, or new ways to think about what you want to write, right?
Yeah, it's been helpful. It's not like I've been, you know, completely rudderless looking for what I want to express, but it's been fun to try to help further my familiarity with my own writing voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only, it hasn't been that long. It's only been like, what, 2 weeks. So, it's,
I would be very interested in getting a check-in on that in another couple weeks.
Cool. You got it. It's, okay. Anything from, getting meta and fourth wall comes out because all of a sudden it's like, I stopped having ideas and now I'm talking about stopping having, I didn't, you know, my ideas ended and all of a sudden new paragraph talking about the, you know, the end of, I don't know, end of a relationship or the end of a, you know, payments on a loan or, I mean, just whatever the heck comes to mind. It's, and it's been fun. So good. It's exercise, basically. It's good exercise.
Yeah.
And
it's an exercise of, I bet, like building associations or finding associations, right? What do you say?
Exactly. But missing that one thing where I think associative exercises are awesome and incredibly helpful, where I like to go through in all my creative projects, I'm starting to find this flow where I go through a generative phase, an associative phase, and then a refinement phase, perhaps a fourth polish phase. anyway, it's super helpful to see, in the association, that's inherently more an act of editing than it is an act of generating. And so this is intentionally about the generating. And if the associations are happening, they're really, really, really fast. So, which may be totally what you meant, but for me, I'm slow.
Free associations as a means to generate writing ideas, right? It's like, okay. So when I'm in a classroom, especially with kids, older kids who don't draw comics that often. So like I just did a talk at the University of Michigan and I had to get the kids drawing and there were kids in there who kids, you know, first year, no, these were grad students. Now that I think about it, they weren't kids. But you know they're pulling the I can't draw card I don't have any ideas. You had me draw four random things and I have like a carpet, a swimming pool, a football, and a shoe. How am I supposed to rope these into a story? Right? I'm like, associate. Just start with what do you think of when you think of swimming pools? Think of water. Come on, go further than that. What do you think of? Just start throwing words on paper of what do you think of when you think of a swimming pool? Well, I think about my 7th birthday party where I almost drowned. Boom, right?
Wow.
That wasn't what happened, but I'm just saying like that kind of thing can happen, right? When I think about swimming pools, I think about the time when some kid tried to pants me in the swimming pool in front of all the girls, right? Embarrassing situation. Okay, that bears investigation. Let's dig deeper into that embarrassment, swimming pool. Where can I go with this, right?
Exactly.
I've
started some of the practice sessions with that, but it always ends up wandering far afield.
It should when you're doing that kind of sloppy writing, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's right. I suppose sloppy writing, another way to just like sloppy drawing.
Sloppy drawing, sloppy writing. I think that both of those things are fantastic. I think it's something we should do more.
What do you think, Jersey? Do we? I think we're hitting close to our hard stop here. So
yeah. So we got to get to your quest, the new quest. But I want to close with this thought, okay? So am I getting slapped back or something?
No. My speakers went to sleep, so that's fine. Ah. You're talking so calm.
Go to sleep, speakers. Gather around, children. I'm going to tell you the final piece of today's discussion on character design. No, I can't do that. Taking things to the next level. So we did the quest. We went through the practice session, which maybe took a little longer than we expected. We had a discussion that kind of sprouted out of doing the quest.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to take it to the next level. It's like, yeah, well, I want to do more of this character design stuff. I want to dig into it deeper. In other words, you, the leaner, you want to create characters with lots of visual appeal, an inner truth that readers will respond to, and a structural necessity that lends to the dignity of your story. Right. And we happen to have this thing called lean into art/lean into art.com/workshops, where I threw in the notes here, we have two dojos to attend in order to master those skills. I don't know if I like that language, but we talk a lot about dojos.
Yeah.
For the first one I would point people at is Tyler James's workshop, Creating Compelling Characters. It's $25. That's leanintoart.com/workshops. Tyler James, creator of the 30 Characters Challenge. Guy knows a little bit about generating character ideas, character designs. It's a great one-off workshop, and I think it's a pretty affordable price if you want to take this to the next level. You'll get a video file and an audio file, no DRM, doesn't expire, and it will take everything that we've talked about today and expand upon it in a lot of interesting ways. Then if you want to go really crazy and you're like, but that's not enough, I need more than that, Krishna Sadasivam's Creating Crazy Characters is four sessions, and he walks through all the visual interest stuff, how to create characters with great silhouettes with lots of visual appeal, and also like body language, how to gestural drawing, how to make your characters look like they're moving. And he walks through all those great Photoshop things that we were talking about earlier that he uses on his art blog on how to like stretch and change. We participated in his workshops, right, Rob? And
oh, yeah.
That was tremendously fun. Now that one is $100, but it's 4 hours of content. And then I will conclude this little pitch for these things by saying that each workshop comes with 12 hours of bonus content where there's one piece of related stuff in the Creative Topics Friday pack, which comes included with any purchase. We did a story, improvisational story lab, where we sat down and we just threw a bunch of random data at the screen on the whiteboard. And together as a group, we knit it together into a pretty interesting story. So that's another thinking exercise that you can participate in to
Actually also a form of your essentially you're using the argument to find the theme of your story, because a lot of it, yeah. There's a great exercise within there where through the exercise coming up with things that you resonate with, and that becomes the basis of the characters and whatnot. And anyway, that was fantastic workshop.
So what does that mean? So like if you spend $25, you get 13 hours of video content. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. But all useful stuff to take you to the next level with this particular building visual appeal, developing inner truth, and structural necessity for your characters. So time for the next quest, Rob.
Okay. Well, I'll make this brief for time and whatnot, but complete. And this will be posted on the Lean Into Art website this evening. So by the time you hear this, it downloaded for sure. It's going to be up. And if you're hearing it now,
leanintoart.com/quests.
Exactly. Thank you, Jersey. Okay. So Lean Into Art Quest 4, Smell of Funny. This is all about jokes. So jokes are an amazing communication device, and I just keep getting fascinated about, you know, picking them apart and trying to understand why do I find something funny and all that. And so that's the driver behind this quest. And so what this is about is exploring how jokes have a setup and a punchline, and how the setup is a premise that somehow you get sucked into, and the punchline surprises you with an alternate, unexpected premise because of something that you were assuming. So it got you to look one way, hit you from the other direction. And then all of a sudden you're delighted. And like, yeah, that's a pretty, that's not funny to talk about how funny works, but it works and it's funny. Like I was watching an episode of Futurama where where Fry was, it's at the, I think it's in one of the recent seasons, and Fry was a police officer in the Future Crimes Division. It's called Law and Oracle. That's the name of the episode.
Yeah.
And that episode is full of jokes that you could use to take on this quest, right? And so what we're going to do here is analyze a joke. Please don't use knock knock jokes. Those aren't so fun. But pick a joke from anywhere. It could be from a comedian. It could be from a joke site. I mean, there's like, you know, kids joke sites, or, you know, like Yahoo jokes, I think. Yahoo kids jokes. There's all sorts of databases of this stuff on the internet. And there's also comic strips of, you know, tons and tons of lots of work out there to analyze. So, I mean, heck, you could pick a pick a joke beat from one of Jersey's comics that you have posted on various places on the internet. Let's see, what would it be? Sugary cereals for which? Let's see, what's one of your comics on sugary cereals? One of yours.
Cosmic Adventures of Gina France.
Oh, there. Cool. All right. Or, for instance, Krishna Sadasivam's PC Weenies, where he has a strip-based comic. And so typically trying to, every single post, have a joke to analyze or to enjoy. But we're here to analyze. And so that's what you need to do. Get a joke. And if you're going to post it somewhere, link to the original post. Give the proper credit to whoever wrote this thing, okay? We want to be honoring all the work of the artists that brought this joke into existence. Even if it's Mark Twain, who has a lot of funny things he said. So for the regular quest, either write it down, doodle it, subtitle it, whatever you want to do, and that captures the joke. And then in the joke that you captured, point out that where the misdirection happens, like what's distracting you, what's the assumption that this joke is causing you to think, and then think about, like, if you were writing that joke, this is optional, that you could also add, it's hard to not give stuff away when you know where you're going to go. You're telling a joke. That's why kids just say punchlines, because that's what's supposed to be funny, right? But okay, that's a fun exercise. Heroic quest. Essentially riff off the joke and come up with an alternate setup and an alternate punchline. And you can do either just with, type it up, scribble it, doodle it, whatever works. And also
sloppy drawing, sloppy writing.
Sloppy, yes. Let's just analyze and find fun in that and see if we can now inform our stuff going forward. That's it.
I got to tell you, Rob, I'm terrified of this one. this is hitting one of my pain points. I don't consider myself a very funny person.
I don't consider myself very funny either. But once in a while, unicorns fart a rainbow.
I like to laugh, but I'm not funny. Yeah. This will be an interesting challenge. I'm looking forward to taking this one on next week. So the deadline for this challenge is March 13th. That will be the day before our next live episode. So cool. You can submit it to us via Twitter or any other social network with the hashtag LIAQuest4. So with that, we'll set everybody on their quests. And this show will be archived at leanintoart.com. Mm-hmm. And if you guys enjoyed this thing and you want to participate or you want to let us know, give us a pat on the back, you could give the show a review on iTunes or, give the video a thumbs up on YouTube. For the most part, it's anonymous. We won't know how many stars you gave us, just however many you think we deserve. I think we deserve quite a few. But, you be the final decider in that in that equation. So anyway, that's at, on iTunes and YouTube. And then the show's at leanintoart.com. Don't forget to check out leanintoart.com/workshops. Until next time, thank you, Rob. I have been.
My pleasure, Jersey. Thank you very much.
I've been Jersey Droz of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't leaners. Thanks for listening.